Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we aromatise your brain with weird and wonderful science. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, James Hayes continues our conversation about the science of odour.
But first up, here's the news. Dark chocolate for health. Dark chocolate has been praised for its antioxidant bioflavonoids and its age-reversing resveratrol, but we've never really been certain of how most of its health benefits work. At the 247th National Meeting and Exposition of the American Chemical Society, it was revealed by John Finley and Maria Moore from the Louisiana State University that dark chocolate feeds certain strains of symbiotic bacteria in our gut, where it's fermented into compounds that reduce inflammation. Inflammation is at the heart of a host of the symptoms of aging and many autoimmune diseases. The good microbes, such as bifidobacterium and lactic acid bacteria, feast on chocolate. They grow and ferment it, producing compounds that are anti-inflammatory. The bad microbes in the gut, including Clostridia and E. coli, are associated with inflammation and can cause gas, bloating, diarrhea, and constipation. Dark chocolate has more antioxidants and less sugar than milk chocolate, and white chocolate doesn't have any of the polyphenols at all. The bad bacteria can feed on the sugar. The compounds the good bacteria make from the dark chocolate lessen the inflammation of cardiovascular tissue, reducing the long-term risk of stroke. It's good for your heart. The team tested three cocoa powders using a model digestive tract. The model was made from a series of modified test tubes to simulate normal digestion. Then they subjected the non-digestible materials in the chocolate to anaerobic fermentation using human fecal bacteria. There are several non-digestible things in chocolate, such as the antioxidant polyphenolic compounds catechin and epicatechin, and a small amount of dietary fiber. Catechin and epicatechin have been identified as healthy ingredients, but we never knew how they helped. The fiber is fermented, and the large polyphenolic polymers are metabolized to smaller molecules, which are more easily absorbed. These smaller polymers exhibit anti-inflammatory activity. The team suggested that combining the fiber in cocoa with prebiotics is likely to improve a person's overall health and help convert polyphenolics in the stomach into anti-inflammatory compounds. Prebiotics are carbohydrates found in foods like raw garlic and cooked whole wheat flour that humans can't digest, but good bacteria like to eat. The good bacteria then outcompete the bad bacteria. Finley said that people could experience even more health benefits when dark chocolate is combined with solid fruits like pomegranates and acai. Looking to the future, he said that the next step would be for industry to do just that, combine these foods. Thanks to Louisiana State University and the American Chemical Society, we now know that fruit dipped in dark chocolate reduces inflammation and reduces your risk of stroke. Uncanny robots. Robots that look like humans start to creep people out the more humanoid they become. The uncomfortably creepy point between where a robot looks like a cartoon and where it looks just like a human is called the uncanny valley. New Scientist reports on roboticists who've been researching ways to avoid the uncanny valley, ironically, by giving the robots little quirks that make them seem more alive. A team from Plymouth University in the UK showed a film of a humanoid Now robot from Aldebaran Robotics from France. They added either sad or cheerful chirps and beeps when the robot was shown being slapped, kissed, stroked, or having its eyes covered. 300 people from the crowdsourcing site Crowdflower were asked to rate what they thought the robot was feeling after each action. They found that people responded the same to the happy or sad sounds, but were much more engaged than when no sound at all was used. It seems that people will take any sound at all to mean that something important is happening, even a random sound, because it gives the appearance of a response from the robot. A team from the University of Wisconsin-Madison have been adding twitches to the way a robot holds its head, so that it's not completely still for very long. They use a face-tracking camera to make sure the robot looks at people it's interacting with. But to avoid a feeling of being stared at, they program the robot to look away from time to time. The team asked 30 students to have a conversation with a now humanoid robot, and the students reported that the robots who looked away from time to time seemed more thoughtful and purposeful. A team from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, found that it matters where the robot appears to be looking, its gaze. If a robot is going to hand you an object, then, like a human, it needs to lock eyes with you first and then look where it's going to put the object for you to take. Anka Dragan of Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh found that introducing a small delay to the robot-human handover made it seem more natural, even though it was more awkward. A tenth of a second was enough to be like the natural human hesitation that people expect. What people expect is important, because the only thing worse than a predictable creepy humanoid robot is a shockingly creepy humanoid robot.
Listening to Ian Wolf on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on diffusionradio.com. In the realm of science, we journey so far, exploring the mysteries of every shining star. With wonder, we delve into the unknown, seeking truths that only science has shown. Oh, the wonders of science, technology, and medicine, unveiling miracles that our world has never seen. From the depths of the oceans to the highest peak, they bring us hope and healing, answers we seek.
Odorific! This is part two of my discussion with Dr. James Hayes about the science of odor. James is a researcher at the University of New South Wales Civil and Environmental Engineering Odor Laboratory. We spoke by Zoom, and I continued our conversation by asking him, what do you think about pheromones? Do humans detect them?
Okay, huge debate. And I guarantee it that if anyone hears this conversation and they know anything about olfactory science, they will probably be angry with me. I'll try and go through it as painlessly as possible. So pheromones are not technically a part of your olfactory sense of smell system. It is a different system called the vomeronasal organ. It's still in your nose, and in other creatures, it does indeed detect pheromones. We have one ourselves. It seems that it doesn't do anything. It just sits there. As far as we're aware, it's useless. It's vestigial. That being said, a lot of people argue about the definition of what a pheromone is. So a lot of people would say, like, so moths, when they want to breed, they will exude a pheromone. That pheromone can be detected at very small concentrations. Other males come up to it. If you include the definition of pheromone to include individuals, then you might say that we have pheromones. So newborns will smell their mother's milk and will smell their mother's odor, and they will definitely know it's their mother more than anybody else. Is that a pheromone? It's at very small concentrations. It might go through the vomeronasal organ. It probably doesn't. Does that count? I personally say no. I'm sure a lot of people would say yes, it does.
And so the other area of controversy with pheromones, of course, is sexual attraction.
Yes.
And if it's not going through that organ...
No. Look, there are certainly odors that improve sexual attraction, especially one of the classic examples is that if you take particular body odors from siblings and then compare like a sister and a brother or another relative, and the woman sits down, they'll smell a particular odor from a relative or something like that, even somebody they don't necessarily interact with that much, and then compare it to a stranger, they tend to prefer the stranger. So there is something there. There is something saying that odors or pheromones are saying, don't interact with this person, they're not a good breeding partner. There is something in that. and there are certain colognes and smells that can be associated with manliness or womanliness. Again, is this like a cheat system? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think that's going to happen.
So more generally, what's happening in our bodies, if it's not a special smell gland or anything like that going on, what makes us smelly?
Okay, so body odor is typically formed with sebaceous oils that we release through our skin. And there are particular bacteria that eat these oils, and they will excrete particular chemicals. They tend to be sulfurs, and as I mentioned before, sulfurs are something that we're very uncomfortable with. The other thing is that there are certain foods. The classic one is garlic. And if you eat garlic, the body odor that you're exuding through your pores, that's not really garlic. That is actually something called allyl methyl sulfide, which is when your body is converting all that garlic into something else, it releases a sulfide. We don't like sulfides in our body. We get rid of it somehow. And that's typically what happens. Again, this is very culturally based. A lot of people coming from Asian countries smell Europeans and Australians, and we smell like off cheese or rancid milk or something like that, because we have a lot of dairy, and that's something that they're not particularly accustomed to. I'm sure you can think of lots of other examples in this regard. So it's very often a cultural experience about how bad a body odor is.
There's suggestions from various regions that certain odors will make you more aware or more relaxed or have different effects on your mood or your feelings. Is that all just cultural and experience association, or is there an actual physiological effect somewhere there?
There's a psychological effect. So using classical conditioning with Little Albert and everything else, and I won't go into Little Albert because it's kind of sad, but if you associate a particular stimulus with something else, so the other classic example, of course, is ringing a bell, and dogs begin to drool because they know when they ring the bell that they're going to receive food. If you have a particular odor and you're doing something in particular, that will basically cause your brain to get into that mood. So what I like to do when I'm studying, I'll have a particular odorant. I like orange, for instance. I sniff a bit of orange, and that tells my brain I'm ready to start thinking properly. With regards to doing anything beyond that kind of classical conditioning, I haven't found anything in the research myself.
And there's talk of dogs having an enormously stronger sense of smell than humans, that they could detect disease if they're trained.
Yes. So I'll give you an example. I'll try and describe just how good dogs are at sniffing things. So we have about 5 million of those smell receptors, olfactory receptor neurons in our brain. That translates us to having about 1 trillion odorants. Comparatively, dogs have 200 million olfactory receptor neurons, and that translates to about 40 trillion odorants if we're just extrapolating. Because to be honest, we don't know how much they can smell things. We don't know at what limits. They are far beyond the limits of our best analytical machines. They are probably far beyond the limits of what we can reproduce in the laboratory. Because at those levels, you don't know if you're causing contamination and things like that. They are very, very good sniffers. Can they smell disease? Yes, they can. This typically has to do with them noticing variations in a person's odor. So they will say, going back to the strawberry, so a strawberry consists of about 7 separate chemicals at different concentrations. They all combine together to create the idea of what a strawberry is. We think, although we can't be certain, that dogs have the same thing. If they smell these particular odors in a particular concentration, they can say, this is a type of cancer, or this is another sort of disease. They've recently trained dogs to detect COVID-19, and it won't probably be from the virus itself because, I mean, they're not really odorants, but it will probably be the body giving off certain chemicals as a part of the response to COVID-19. The other good example is that without training, dogs can typically detect when their owners are about to go through a shock or some sort of seizure due to diabetes, and they smell sweet and they'll start licking the owner to let them know that something's going to happen.
And of course, controversially is police sniffer dogs, because there seem to be studies showing that they pay more attention to what their handlers want than what they're smelling.
This is true. There are ways of avoiding it. We do find that there's laboratory, I was about to say lab, but I think that'd confuse it if we're talking about dogs. There are laboratory tests which show dogs are exceptionally good sniffers. When that translates to real world setting, they tend to do a fair bit more poorly. This can be a variety of reasons. If it's a training procedure on the part of the handler, then there's certainly potential to fix that problem if that's what it is, but we don't really know. It could be cues we're unconsciously providing to the dogs. It could have something to do with their training regimen. It could have potentially something to do with the environment and their missing cues in a way that we just don't understand yet. Again, because testing with dogs is so challenging, answering these questions requires a huge amount of very careful and considered approaches. And we kind of need to do that if we're going to improve detection dog outcomes.
And of course, with COVID-19, one of the symptoms that some people report is a loss of smell.
Yes. I read about this a little while ago and I was quite fascinated. So typically what happens with most colds and flus, you will have a person start off, their mucus will kind of build up and accumulate and get cloggy, and that'll stop chemicals getting to those receptor neurons, and then it'll get progressively worse. With COVID, your sense of smell just shuts off immediately, really aggressively. The reason for that being is that you have special structural cells that keep up your receptor neurons, and the inflammation response from your body causes those cells to inflame and not do their job properly. So it's kind of like pitching a tent and then having the tent poles kind of fall around you and not doing their job. And that's what happens. Fortunately, it's also been reported that your sense of smell does return once the virus has left your body.
Because there were suggestions in the press that it was the smelling parts of the brain rather than just the senses in the nose that were going a bit wrong.
That seems unlikely. There is some very interesting research in looking at how the olfactory senses of the brain can be used to measure certain mental ailments and things like that. So, for instance, there is a smell test that is very accurate, more accurate than trained physicians, to say whether someone has high-functioning autism or Asperger's. And this is based upon people smelling a suite of odorants and the way in which that they react to particular odors and assess their intensity gives what we like to call an olfactory signature. And it'll look like a little graph. And we can say, with that kind of signature, this person probably has Asperger's. It's also used for a variety of other things. I think the core thing to understand for this is that olfactory receptor neurons are brain cells. All of this is going through the brain. So if there's something wrong or different mentally, then you can use neurons to check that. In fact, there's a research group led by McKay Sim down in the south of Australia, and he's extracting olfactory receptor neurons completely from the nose, and he's running tests on them, putting them under the microscope, and that's also providing some diagnostic abilities for certain mental ailments.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool stuff.
Well, that relates back to the earlier question I had about where a sense of smell can cut in and out.
Yes.
Absent for a while and then suddenly there and then suddenly gone and brain.
Yeah, a loss of smell is actually a very, very good predictor of imminent loss of life.
Ooh.
It has a 5-year prediction for mortality. If you do find yourself, for some reason, losing your sense of smell, I recommend going to a doctor. And this has things to do with the fact that because these olfactory receptor neurons keep growing back, there's something wrong with the cells regenerating, and that might imply that other things are happening with the body that you might not be aware of.
Goodness. Would you go to see a neurologist or an ENT specialist?
I don't think I'd go to either. I think I'd just go to a doctor because it'll predict things like something's wrong with your heart, something's wrong with your liver. Just have an all-round check because it could be all sorts of things.
Well, that's a good one for people to know. Yeah, I was asking about the sense of smell going on and off because I've had that for about 17 years since I got Ciguatera fish poisoning. I don't even notice that it's missing until it suddenly comes back and I can smell again. It's like, oh, yeah.
What kind of fish poisoning is that?
Oh, it's called Ciguatera. It's a tropical
disease. Oh, the tropical fish stuff. Yes, that would have happened. because it's a neural-based poison. Yes, I've heard of that.
Yeah.
And that'll just click on and off. Oh, that's terrible. I'm so sorry to hear that.
And it's really odd because you don't notice as much when your sense of smell goes because it's an absence. But when it suddenly comes back, you're going, oh, forgot about that.
I won't go into details. That has to do with something called olfactory adaptation and habituation. Really, really complicated cascades of hormones and stuff telling your body not to overdo it. But if your body isn't prepared, it'll hit you with those things really aggressively.
Yes. So it's an interesting experience.
We were talking about how we can say we can smell lemon and then we can smell strawberry. What I like to describe it as, and I'm sure you have some musos listening to this, if you think of a keyboard and the smell of lemon is just one chemical, limonene, and that's like just pressing a single key on the keyboard. Meanwhile, you have things like chords. So the C chord consists of three separate notes. They're played at the same time. And when you detect it in your ear, you're not really hearing three notes, you're hearing just one note. And that's how strawberry behaves. Strawberries consists of seven separate chemicals, and they all need to have a particular concentration at a particular interaction with your olfactory receptor neurons, and that will produce one, let's call it note, of strawberry. And that's how a lot of chemicals work. That's how we can extrapolate from just 5 million olfactory receptor neurons into 1 trillion separate odorants. And once that smell goes, so in our evolutionary past, we devoted a lot of our brain power to our sense of smell. Over the years, because we've become apex predators and all other sorts of things, our sense of smell has become less important to us. So those parts of the brain are where emotions now exist. As a result, when you smell things, they still go through those parts of the brain. And that's why we have a very strong emotional connection to perfumes and colognes, and we have such an aversion to body odor because it has an emotional characteristic to it that no other senses really have.
So the sense of smell deteriorates as you age.
Yes.
Is there anything people can do about that? Or can you just increase your perception of it by training it or paying more attention?
You can pay more attention to it. A long time ago, what I would have loved to do was conduct an experiment where you have people who are a little bit older and they're losing their sense of smell. And as a result, they're not able to access those olfactory memories that we were talking about before. There would certainly be a way that we could artificially correct for that and improve and enhance concentrations of particular chemicals that they're losing their ability to detect, so they can get those olfactory memories back and improve their quality of life. I think with an aging population, I think that's a really viable way of improving the lives of a lot of different people. I would love to do it, but we'll have to see where the funding comes from.
Well, there's also, of course, industrial electronic noses.
Yes. Now, my boss, Professor Richard Sturtz, who leads the Odor Laboratory, he's done a lot of work with electronic noses. Electronic noses are valuable in certain circumstances, but they do have some pretty severe limitations typically. They're only able to detect a handful of odorants. In industrial application, that's typically things like sulfur and other really strong odorants that people are going to be upset with. You can apply them to other experiences as well. Their detection ability is usually worse than humans. So they're valuable for detecting like gross odor violations where things have gone very considerably wrong. But when it comes to like quite fine tuning things, they're not as useful. The other problems are is that they're quite expensive. They require a lot of upkeep because again, like our noses, they're interacting with volatile chemicals all the time. And so that'll degrade their ability to detect things. So yeah, I do feel that they have uses. I don't think that the technology is there yet to really replace the human nose. I don't think it's going to be here for decades. Our best analytical machines, in some instances, aren't better than the human nose.
That was the second part of my interview with James Hayes about odour. Next week, James will start with smell-o-vision.
And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker, or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions, and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please rate the show on iTunes and Spotify. Tell your friends. Follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and Mastodon at Ian Wolfe.
The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.
I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including Tune FM at the University of Armidale in New South Wales, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, 4DDD in Dalby and the Darling Downs in Queensland, 4RPH in Brisbane, Denmark FM in Western Australia, 6GME Golari in Broome, Radio Adelaide in South Australia, Lofty FM in the Adelaide Hills, 2XXFM in Canberra, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, and Print Radio in Hobart. Diffusion is narrowcast on Indigo FM 88 in Northeast Victoria. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 1,300 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords, so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf. You can also support Diffusion by buying from the Diffusion Science Etsy store. I'm Ian Wolfe. Join me inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick, everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography, collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.